Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm Philip Brasher. Our guest this week is the Senate Republican Whip, John Thune, who joins us to discuss the war in Ukraine, as well as supply chain disruptions that continue to plague U.S. agriculture. But first, here's this week's headlines. The war in Ukraine drags on with no end in sight, and there are growing fears about the impact the war will have on global grain supplies and on the price of fertilizers critical to world food production. There's concern both about the current winter wheat crop in Ukraine, as well as the crops due to be planted this spring. Ukraine is a major world supplier of wheat, corn, and vegetable oil. At least so far, the impact of the war appears to be manageable, at least in the short term. USDA this week raised its estimate of global wheat stocks despite the war, but the department warned there is a lot of uncertainty about what will ultimately happen to grain and oilseed supplies. Back at home, congressional leaders have finally agreed on a massive $1.5 trillion bill to fund the federal government for fiscal 2022. The bill provides USDA with more than $500 million in new funding for rural broadband. It also contains a provision requiring USDA to establish a cattle contract library. The goal of that program is to ensure that producers have the information they need to negotiate better prices for their cattle. And finally, for consumers, inflation just keeps roaring along. Supermarket prices shot up 1.4% in February, and they're now up 8.6% over the past 12 months. That's the largest 12-month increase in nearly 41 years. And keep in mind, those February numbers don't fully account for the impact of the war in Ukraine and the impact it's having on markets. Now, Senator Thune joins us to talk about the impact of the Ukraine crisis and what Congress is going to do about those supply chain disruptions. Senator, thank you for being here. I want to turn first to the war in Ukraine. It just keeps dragging on. There doesn't seem to be any end to this. In addition to the misery that we're seeing in Ukraine, there are growing fears about what this means for the global food supplies and food security worldwide. We've saw global food prices in February hit an all-time high. The consumer price index here at home, grocery prices are up 8.6% in the past year. When do we really start worrying about the impact that this could have on the food supply?
Well, I think we already have. If they can't plant this spring, Ukraine is a big agricultural producer of a number of commodities that are important to the supply chain here in the United States and around the world. And if for some reason that production falls off as a result of the war, that could have some significant impacts on global supplies. Now, there are some expectations that perhaps India, Australia, other countries around the world that grow similar type commodities can replace the amount of volume that's lost. But I think we have to be prepared, Phil, for that potential. I don't think it's an inevitability yet because we don't know how this is all going to end, but I think we have to be prepared. And USDA is already looking at some of those numbers and has come to the conclusion that you could see wheat, for example, off about 12% globally. And that's a big number when you consider the amount of miles we have to feed around the world today and the fact that some of those global supplies were already tight.
Now, to deal with this, the ranking Republican on the Senate Agriculture Committee this week called for delaying enrollment in the Conservation Reserve Program, and there's also even been the suggestion that we ought to open up CRP land to emergency cropping this year to try to fill that gap. Good idea?
Yeah, and I don't think that's not something I support, certainly not at this point. I think right now these contracts are locked in for a long period of time. It'd be very disruptive for farmers to do that. And obviously the CRP program, there's for a reason. A lot of it has to do with soil health. And I think there are a lot of these areas that are in the CRP program that are marginal grounds that probably shouldn't be broken up, that are more suitable to native grasses and that sort of thing. So that's not something that I think is necessary, at least not yet. And you know, for lots of reasons, not something I'm ready to support, although I know people are trying to come up with ideas that are creative and outside the box. That to me isn't one of them, at least at this point, that we ought to be considering.
Turn to energy prices for a second. Gasoline in the DC area is over $4 a gallon. What can be done in the short term beyond trying to get OPEC countries to increase production in order to soften the impact of energy prices on consumers?
I think, one, approved drilling permits. You know, they talk about these leases that have been granted, but it's a second step in the process to allow an energy company to go in and actually drill for oil. And they tell me that even a new well, not even an existing one, but a new well, from the time they drill into the ground to where the oil is flowing is about 21 days. So, I mean, if you're looking at increasing the global liquid fuel supply, that certainly is one way of doing it. I think this administration has to send some signals that we want American energy producers to get off the bench, get back into the game. And, you know, right now the signals have all been the opposite. It's like, we're discouraging it. They're discouraging financial institutions from lending to companies that produce energy. And then the other thing I would mention, which is good for agriculture too, Phil, is just let's increase the use of biofuels. I mean, if we went to E15 and that was encouraged by the administration, that displaces a significant amount of foreign oil from, you know, other countries around the world on whom we depend today. And I think this is an opportunity for agriculture to step up, if the administration would be so willing, and entertain the idea of expanding the use of biofuels to help meet the liquid fuel demand the country's gonna face. And if you look at it right now, ethanol is $1.20 a gallon less than traditional gasoline, so the more of that you can integrate into the fuel mix in this country, you could bring the cost down for consumers too. So it's really a win-win. And those are a couple of things I think right off the bat, if the administration is serious about American energy independence, and all of the above strategy makes sense, and that includes not only traditional oil and gas, but biofuels as well.
But can you increase ethanol production without creating more pressure on our grain stocks and our food supplies?
There's going to be, obviously, you know, when you convert food to fuel, there will be. I mean, it'll create additional demand out there, but I think our farmers in this country at least are up to it. And if you look at the types of yields that we're getting and with the use of biotechnology, I think they're up to it. I think they would welcome the opportunity to be someone who meets the demand not only for food around the world, but also for fuel. And so I think, again, ethanol now, biofuels has become a global commodity as well, and there are other countries around the world that can step up and help meet that demand. But it's good for agriculture, it's good for the environment. Yeah, you know, burns 46% cleaner than traditional gasoline, and it's good for the consumers because, like I said, it's a significant price differential now, substantially, between traditional gasoline and ethanol in the marketplace. So it could be a win-win all the way around.
We'll be right back with more from Senator Thune.
Farm Credit supports rural communities and agriculture with reliable, consistent credit and financial services in good times and bad. We provide loans to farmers and ranchers, farmer-owned cooperatives, rural homebuyers, agribusinesses, and rural infrastructure providers. As cooperatives, we're locally owned and governed. We help agricultural producers feed the world. For America's farmers, Farm Credit, supporting rural communities and agriculture. Learn more today.
Welcome back. Supply chain disruptions and bottlenecks of ports continue to be a problem for farmers and processors who are trying to get agricultural goods into export markets. We asked Senator Thune about his bill, the Ocean Shipping Reform Act, that attempts to address this problem. The House passed a bill, it's actually passed it twice, that would force ocean carriers to take agricultural products on containers, not take them away empty, back to China or wherever they were sourced. You are co-sponsoring a bill in the Senate, doesn't go quite that far, but still would address this this issue. What are the prospects for that?
You know, I think they're good, Phil. The House bill, as you mentioned, is more prescriptive than what we have proposed, but we do get at the issue of unfair practices and the unfair use of detention and demurrage charges on shippers, and the discriminatory practice of some of these carriers who will say, well, we're gonna transport the high value commodity, but we're not gonna transport your agricultural commodity. And in some cases, you have containers going back to other countries that are empty. Mm-hmm. Empty. Mm-hmm. And so this just gives the Federal Maritime Commission the tools that it needs and the recourse that our shippers need with respect to these carriers when some of these unfair practices are being implemented. And a dispute resolution process, recourse. And I think it's really important that we do something. You know, the administration has some things that it can do that it hasn't chosen to do. And so Congress is looking at remedies, and I think this bill, it's a bipartisan bill, Senator Klobuchar from Minnesota and I and about 25 other co-sponsors right now. We had a hearing on it in front of the Senate Commerce Committee last week. There's discussion about potentially marking the bill up and reporting it out to the floor. And I just think we need to act. I think we need solutions, and this really is kind of long overdue. We did a similar thing with the Surface Transportation Board, which regulates railroads, a few years ago, and many of the changes that we recommended to the way the Federal Maritime Commission operates with respect to containers, ocean carriers, has some of the same basic principles and kind of the same framework, if you will, that we applied to rail carriers a few years ago. I think it makes sense. I think it's high time we do it, and I'm hoping we can get some bipartisan support to get it on the floor and get it passed and on the president's desk.
What do you say to critics like your colleague Mike Lee from Utah, who say that this would, could actually make things worse? Carriers would either skip U.S. ports or empty containers would be left in ports, just worsening the bottlenecks there.
Yeah, well, I disagree with that. And I think that, I'm not sure that, I know he made some derogatory comments about the bill at a hearing last week, but I don't think, I was not there at the time, so I didn't have a chance to react at the moment, but I did respond when I came back to the hearing room. And I think, again, it's a basically perhaps maybe a slight misinterpretation of what the bill actually does. But I don't think at all that we are in any way impeding or making it harder. I think we're expediting and making it easier for shippers who use these carriers, the containers, to haul things back and forth from different countries around the world to be able to make sure that they're treated fairly. And really all it is creating kind of what I would call a level playing field, and so that commodities that are being shipped, whether they're agricultural or otherwise, are treated in a fair way and aren't stuck with these not only unfair but unnecessary detention and demurrage charges that in many cases carriers will impose and shippers are hit with through no fault of their own. A lot of times it's the carrier himself or itself that is responsible for what might be the backlog. But I think the whole goal here is to reduce the number of obstacles, the bottlenecks that exist in our supply chain today. And this right now is one of them, and it's an important one at the ports. And I think we've got to do something to address it. I think this bill does that. And notwithstanding what some of the critics may say, I think it's important that we take action. And this is a very, I think, solution-oriented approach.
Well, thank you. We'll continue to watch that issue and be talking with you further. Thank you, Senator, for being with us today. We'll be right back to discuss this week's news with our panel. But first, Hannah Pagel takes a look at global wheat production and how the Russian war in Ukraine can affect the global food supply.
As the Russian invasion in Ukraine stretches into its third week, the impact the war is having on the global food supply chain has created many concerns over where and how the rest of the world will get its food. Ukraine is a major global supplier of wheat, corn, and vegetable oil. When you add Russia into the mix, the two account for 1/3 of the world's wheat production. Currently, Ukraine has its winter wheat crop in the ground, but at this point, it's unclear how much of the country's crop will be harvested, exported, or even planted this upcoming spring. In an effort to mitigate a food supply disruption, proposals have been going around looking to ramp up agricultural production by planting crops on this year's conservation acres in the United States and Europe. According to the European Commission, there are roughly 5 million acres of idled farmland that could be planted in the EU, whereas the United States Conservation Reserve Program has roughly 22 million acres. A spokesperson for USDA said there were no discussions about opening CRP, and it's not clear how much land farmers would be willing to plant, especially given much of the southern and central plains is in the middle of a drought. Earlier this week, though, the top Republican on the Senate Agriculture Committee, John Bozeman, wrote a letter to Secretary Vilsack saying the idea should be on the table. To get a closer look at this map, head to agripulse.com. For this week's Map It Out, I'm Hannah Pagel.
Farmers are always there for each other. We shed tears together, we celebrate together, but we also grow together. Farm Bureau is the largest general farm organization in the country. We have the farmers' back. If you're a farmer and you're not a member, we would welcome you into our Farm Bureau family. And if you want to know more about agriculture, come be part of this great family.
Welcome back. Here is our panel. With us are Dana Brooks, a veteran of agriculture and food policy and president and CEO of the Pet Food Institute; Scott Irwin, a leading economist from the University of Illinois; and Dave Salmonson, a senior director of congressional relations at the American Farm Bureau Federation, where he specializes in trade policy. And Scott, I want to start with you and talk about the impact of the war in Ukraine and the impact it could have on our food supply. You've caught some attention up to and including the Department of Agriculture with a proposal to open up land that's now set aside under the Conservation Reserve Program to emergency cropping this year. Is the situation really that dire?
Well, at the present moment, we could say probably not. But the issue is, if the war continues in its present trajectory, and looking at the news as best we can absorb it, there's a real potential for a really significant diminishment of Ukraine's ability to get its spring crops planted and to harvest later this summer their winter wheat crop. And the way I like to put that into perspective is that in terms of their plantings, the Ukraine's acreage is just under about 60 million acres that they typically plant in the spring. This is equal to roughly the size of total crop area in Iowa and Illinois. So we're looking at potentially a hole in global grain supplies equal in size to the states of Iowa and Illinois. And that doesn't even get into other potential knock-on effects. So it's potentially like nothing that at least I've experienced in my lifetime in terms of a supply shock.
Well, what's plan B? I mean, the word we get from the USDA is there are no discussions about opening CRP. What could plan B be, and how long do we have before we need to try to do something up to open up some more acreage to get farmers to plant more? Or this really
becomes
a problem?
Well, we know that market incentives will work. We will eventually get the acreage response globally with these incredible price increases. But one of the problems here is timing, is that this crisis has hit, you know, just as farmers around in the Northern Hemisphere are getting ready to go to the fields and begin planting. So there's very, very little time for response to either the high prices or policy changes. So we're into a true crisis mode. And my idea was just simply to say, okay, it's time for some out of the box thinking. What can we do besides just rely on the market here, if anything?
And data, those prices can make a difference to your members, pet food manufacturers, just as they do to makers of human food. How worried are your member companies about the prices of commodities and ingredients and the impact that this war could have going forward?
We just wrapped up our board meeting yesterday, and it's top of mind. It's the number one concern for our manufacturers. Sourcing ingredients, it's increased pricing. It's an incredible challenge. And some of our companies have said this is the worst they've ever experienced with price and availability of ingredients. So it's top of mind and very concerning for us.
What do they think should be done?
Well, you know, first and foremost, we support U.S. agriculture and our agribusinesses. And this is, you know, this is our market. These are our ingredient suppliers. Our challenge right now is really about the competition with renewable diesel that's coming online. We're going to see an increase of 5 times production of renewable diesel by 2024. So we're already competing in the market, and we understand that. But that's seeing this reduction in supply and concerns that's going on in Ukraine, the breadbasket of the world, we just have we're just seeing a real challenge moving forward, and not sure when that's going to let up with this additional competition in supply. And we came out of our board meeting saying we want to feed people and pets first.
Well, on that note, we'll be right back after this message.
Looking closer, seeing further. That's how we do it. At Curious Plot, we're driven to find what's next for agriculture, animal care, and food. We stay curious because that's what it takes to grow understanding. That's how we plot strategies and tell stories that get results time after time. Marketing, communications, and consulting that look closer and see further. Curious Plot. We can't wait to help you tell your story.
Dave, I want to turn to the supply chain disruptions that continue to trouble agriculture. We've had a lot of problems getting goods out of ports, particularly ports like Los Angeles and Long Beach on the West Coast, trying to get products into containers. The House passed a bill, actually passed it twice, that would force ocean carriers to accept and take U.S. exports. They've been taking containers empty. The Senate has a version, doesn't have quite the teeth, and the Senate hasn't moved on that bill yet. How much do you think this bill would help?
I do think that this legislation would give some more teeth to the Federal Maritime Commission, and it would help encourage, and in some places require, the ocean carriers to take agricultural cargoes, and would certainly give them motivation to move these containers off the docks. We know what has happened with all of the disruptions from COVID, and we know that this has been going on now, it seems, well, a couple years now. And there's still probably 75 ships awaiting to dock at Los Angeles, Long Beach, and other ports around the country are starting to also report ships waiting, slowdowns in that. So I think this legislation will be able to get rid of, we hope, some unfair charges that ag exporters are facing if their containers don't move for reasons beyond their control. I mean, there's trucking issues, there's inland distribution issues. There's a lot of things affecting movement of cargo and containers through the ports. And it also allows the Federal Maritime Commission, I think, to really get in and be involved with how ocean carriers are doing their business and how they're moving cargoes, especially agricultural export cargoes. So I think this will lead to some good changes, and we're certainly hopeful that the situation, both from the logistics side and from the management side, will improve and we can move our ag export cargoes. You know, there was a discussion out and some work and research done that thought of up to $4 billion of U.S. ag exports that would have moved in containers didn't move last year. You know, we had a very good ag export year last in 2021. It could have been better.
Dave, well, what do you say to those critics who say this could actually make things worse, this legislation, by it would discourage carriers from stopping at U.S. ports, or it would actually, they would leave empty containers at those ports, just creating worse bottlenecks?
I don't think the legislation is going to have that effect. I think this is a very reasoned approach to this issue. And I think in the implementation of it, remember, this is really giving some work, again, some more ability to the Federal Maritime Commission. And of course, they listen to both sides, they listen to the carriers, they listen to the exporters. I think things can be worked out and make a better export situation for everybody, including U.S. agriculture.
And Dane, I'll give you the last word. How optimistic are you that some form of this legislation is going to pass? And is there anything else that the administration should be doing?
I think that we have a lot of support in the Congress, recognition that we need to be moving our products in and out of the United States. We see the opportunity to move forward with this, and I sincerely hope that the Senate can proceed with passage and that the White House will support final bill. And that will just maybe ease some of the burdens that we're experiencing now with transportation logistics as well.
Well, thank you. That's all the time that we have. Dana, Scott, Dave, thanks for being here. We'll be right back with more AgriPulse Newsmakers. But first, we have a farmer question from the field.
Thanks for joining us for this week's From the Field. Our question this week comes to us from the Commodity Classic in New Orleans and involves one of the hottest topics in agriculture. Check it out.
Hi, I'm Brandon Honeycutt, a corn, soybean, and popcorn farmer from Nebraska. One of the issues I am really wondering about is how farmers will be compensated fairly within a carbon market.
Hey, Brandon. Thanks for the question. So carbon markets are a complicated topic and one that a lot of folks in Washington are trying to better understand. The size of the payments farmers are going to get from sequestering carbon on their farms is really going to depend on how much these markets develop. Right now, they're at the very early stages. Payments so far can be pretty modest. One company that's been in the forefront of this sector is Truterra, a unit of Land O'Lakes. Last year, Truterra distributed about $4 million to farmers for sequestering over 200,000 metric tons of carbon. The payments averaged about $20,000, with the biggest checks topped at $100,000. Truterra has been paying $20 per ton for carbon sequestered by recently adopted soil management practices. Legislation is pending in Congress to try and help farmers with the measurement and verification of their carbon-related practices. The Growing Climate Solutions Act has passed the Senate, but not the House. That bill would create a program at USDA to certify farm advisors and credit verification services. There have been suggestions that USDA could shore up carbon prices by purchasing credits from farmers, but there has been no action on that idea. If you'd like to see your question answered on From the Field, send an email to newsmakers@agripulse.com. For AgriPulse, I'm Hannah Pagel.
Join us for the 2022 AgriPulse Ag and Food Policy Summit. Speakers will discuss the groundwork for the next Farm Bill on March 21st at the National Press Club and through our virtual experience. Register today under the Events tab at agripulse.com.
Agriculture Future of America is a nonprofit building transformational leaders in food and agriculture. AFA prepares college students to join the workforce as innovative and engaged young professionals who will shape the future of agriculture. Head to agfuture.org to find out how you can get involved.
Before we let you go, here's what's on the horizon for the week to come. Tuesday is an important day for farmers. It's the last day for producers to make selections of the main Farm Bill commodity programs. It's the deadline to sign up for those $5 per acre payments being offered to farmers again this year for planting cover crops. And Tuesday's also the closing sales date for crop insurance in much of the country. The House Agriculture Committee will continue its Farm Bill review by taking a look at how USDA programs are addressing climate change. As always, stay tuned to AgriPulse.com for the latest developments in ag and food policy. For AgriPulse Newsmakers, I'm Philip Rasher. Good day.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. For more ag policy news, visit AgriPulse.com. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more.